bows and swords against me. No one, the barely moustached young Wilderlord snapped imperiously. That included a little mercenary army led by a common spellmonger. I really don't like being snapped at by a man who has never stood in combat, and who further believes that his noble status justifies poor manners. I saw plenty of good men die in Faerys, because such self-important men commanded them stupidly. This fair-cheeked snot was quite adamant about the Lord of Gan's Order, though, proclaiming the Bovol Valley was a lost cause, and broadly hinting that my forces would be better spent defending his own realm instead of Cusi's. I let the rage burn a little in my heart, then called upon a powerful domination spell. It's actually a pretty easy spell to master, as it has no physical effects. It's a blue magic spell that just makes you seem 3 times as dangerous as you appear normally to the ones you want to dominate. To the pipsqueak lordling, I suddenly became 8 feet tall, broad-shouldered and fighting mad. The last part was not intrinsically part of the spell. I was just pissed. I looked at him, looked at his little roadblock of 100 or so men, and looked back at my troop column of over 1,000. Then I told my staff to prepare for action. "My lord," I said as calmly as possible, "we are going through the Moor Pass on our lawful business, in defiance of your lord's wishes. You may elect to try to stop us."
"By Huin's axe, we will stop you,"
the teenaged knight insisted haughtily,
"and it will be the last fight you ever see."
"Oh, you misunderstand me," I said, my eyes narrowing. The boy was taken aback and put his hand on his sword. He was clearly ready to fight us, even against overwhelming odds, in furtherance of his chivalric ideal. I'm not a knight, though. There are some things the nobility fears even more than glorious death in battle. If you do try to stop me, I will not order my men to fight.
"You won't?"
he asked, confused. "No, my lord. I will merely release all these men from their contracts. After they are released, they will have nowhere to go and no money with which to support themselves. They will doubtless turn to raiding, and inside a week your domain will be stripped so bare the Govani will have to go around it to find anything worth looting. So what shall I do, my lord?" I said, intensifying the spell. The Wilderlord considered the matter carefully, a look of confusion on his acne-covered face, for about 5 seconds. The Crinrock alone made the rest of my mercenaries look respectable, but not by much. Clearly the thought of them all looting the cots and holds of Gans was vivid in his mind. He let us pass, and with just a little more pressure, grudgingly promised to petition his lord to send 50 archers to Castle Brandmount as a visible token of his esteem and support for his sister domain in its time of need. After all, he pointed out nervously, Bovol and Gans both served the same baron. We went past and into the valley without further human disruption, but neither could we expect human intervention. From the time we passed the Moor Tower and its 30-man garrison, I had everyone prepare to be attacked at any moment from any hillock, wood, or ridge top we crossed. We began to see signs of Govani raids along the road, including a few furry black corpses that some lucky archer had got to, but we also saw a few corpses of humans who had been slain and left by the side of the road. More unsettling, a quick scrying told me that there were Govani sentries and spies hiding about too, but I was more concerned for getting my troops and their wagons through than hunting them down. We arrived at Brandmount Castle without incident, and I detailed several wagons of arms and food to be deployed there, as well as assigning the Gorbarban Order and about half the independent mercenaries to Sire Cusi's younger brother, who looked like he would break into tears of gratitude. They needed the infantry badly. Brandmount was an older fortress, not designed to be defended by cavalry, nor had it accommodations for that many horses. The Order's pikes would mean more there than at Bovol Castle, and splitting the mercenaries kept them from fighting amongst each other. The rest I took south, toward Himmis, to reinforce Sire Cusi. The landscape was eerily quiet as we rode south, passing Himmis Lake and the isolated farmsteads and pastures that surrounded it. The cottages were empty. I saw few farm animals and even less people the closer we came to the castle. But there were signs of struggle here and there, not just abandonment. Occasionally I saw the head of a Gervan or two stuck on a sharpened stick next to the road. It was a uselessly defiant, overly gory gesture, but one that was good for human morale. At least security near to the fortress was good. As we approached Beauval Castle, we were stopped no less than 4 times by sentries. The first 3 were jumpy peasant militiamen in leather jacks and wielding spears, axes, and pitchforks, while the 4th were real men-at-arms, spared from the castle for the duty. Each time my long train passed a checkpoint, the Bovali broke into cheers. As we lumbered up the last stretch of road approaching the castle proper, peasants lined the roadway to cheer us on, throwing flowers in our path. A first for my Crinrock barbarians, who were more used to less savory objects being thrown at them by Narasi peasants. Sir Kusi himself was waiting at the main gate of the castle in full armor and mounted on his warhorse, his tired face split into a toothy grin as I rode ahead of the long columns spread out behind me. He stood in the saddle to shout a greeting.
"Hail, Master Spellmonger, well met!"
he bellowed to me over the cheers of the crowd. "I see you have hired us an army." "Of sorts, if you aren't too picky about the term," I said, glad the men were mostly out of earshot. "I left just under 1/2 of my forces at Brandmount Castle with your brother to shore up defences there. But I have over 500 with me, plus friends and relatives, and arms and ammunition as well." "They are graciously welcomed. I had no idea that you would be able to secure so many so quickly, but I applaud your efforts. Feeding them might be difficult in the days to come, but every man on the battlements is one more who can slay goblins." As to feeding them, I took the liberty of buying several wagon loads of provisions while in Tudri, enough to cover the mercenaries, and then some. They are at the rear of the column, along with a fair number of additional arms. Sire Kusi looked impressed and relieved. He hadn't discussed that before I'd gone. He nodded toward the mercenary cavalry and the Wilderlands knights, who were in the vanguard of the march. "You are a wizard, indeed, to have chosen so well and with such foresight." I grimaced uncomfortably. I felt more like I was leading a circus, not an army. But after leading them, I was more than ready to turn them over to their new master. "I'd like to think so. Your neighbors in Gans gave me trouble about crossing their lands, but I convinced them to let us pass. They may yet send some archers to Brandmount, though I wouldn't put them on the rolls until they arrive in earnest." The old knight looked wearily at the eastern ridge and sighed. "I know all about that. I've had 3 messages in your absence. My fellow Wilderlords were not pleased with the developments in Beauval of late, despite the increase in goblin raids on their own lands. Things have been busy here. You may have seen the severed heads along the road. Yet Gans and Pressans have not had a tithe of the action we've seen, and cluck in alarm like frightened fowl, not brave knights. They have yet to send us anything but their tepid good wishes. They fear for their own lands, and I suppose I cannot blame them. But come inside. Much has happened since you left, and there is much to discuss. Join me at luncheon, and I will brief you." Far be it for me to pass up a free meal, especially after eating trail rations for the last week. I nodded and rode in, could see himself leading Traveller to the stables as a sign of honour, while the Castellan came forward and started organising the arriving mercenaries, arranging for their camps to be pitched inside the inner bailey, away from the villagers. A good move. The locals would object to foreign warriors sharing their rations and ravishing their daughters, and the Crinrock in particular might take offence at some of the Bovali peasants' harsh jibes at their tribal ways. Best to keep a good strong wall between them. After seeing to my horse, I followed Kusi into the great donjon and up into his private chamber, where we found lunch was already set. It was quieter than the last time I had been here. We were only interrupted 3 between our first bite and our last. "So," the old knight said as he wiped honey away from his moustache with his finger, "exactly what have you brought me, and how much did it cost, Master Minelan?" I took out the manifest I had prepared and slid it across to him. He read over it and nodded. "Excellent work, my boy. Not what I hoped for exactly, but well under the budget I gave you. A few more knights would have been helpful," he muttered. No matter where they're from, the chivalry think that heavy cavalry is the epitome of the warrior's art. Well done, nevertheless. Now, let me fill you in on what has passed since your departure. For the next hour, he told me about the steady increase in Gavanni raids across the valley, interfering with his folk coming to the castle. Most were mere skirmishes at dusk and dawn, the time when both races were awake. Some had been full-on nocturnal attacks, picking off isolated crofts or caravans on the road. Small squads of 5 or 6 Gavanni would set upon whatever isolated peasants they found, but avoided our warriors, like the sunshine, and never attacked at all unless the odds were distinctly in their favour. That didn't always help. Cassie's brother and 2 of his men were ambushed riding towards Beauvall Castle a few days ago, though they had been driven off. Apparently the Gavanni weren't used to attacking cavalry, or well-armed humans, and the younger Brandmount had left a pile of 7 heads next to the road as testament to their foolishness. Cousy was quite proud of that. More often the resistance was weaker, and the goblins got the better of the bargain. Mutilated human bodies had been found in the fields and ditches of Beauvall every morning since the first attack on Minden Hall. They were usually stripped and despoiled, and occasionally positioned obscenely, in ways designed to terrorize the human population. The Gavanni struck without regard to gender or age, and that had raised the ire of Cousy's already frightened subjects, but it also speeded their preparations for a siege. No one wants to wake up and realize that Grandma is lying outside the chicken coop, stripped and eviscerated, or that Junior has wandered off to meet a girl by moonlight and had his testicles cut off and stuffed. Well, no need to go into that. The attacks had had one important benefit. Everyone was taking the goblin threat seriously now, and wasted no more time in getting their families and livestock relocated behind stout fortress walls. When I inquired after our laughable magical core, Cousy nodded approvingly in a way that made me automatically nervous. He told me how Garkescu had led his apprentices on a 3-day whirlwind tour of the castle grounds, laying wards, using strengthening runes on the walls, gates, and towers, making suggestions about firefighting battles scattered throughout the area, and generally being far more useful than Cousy or myself had expected. Was this a new side to Garkescu? I really couldn't say. To be honest, I barely knew him, even in a professional capacity. While I found his business practices questionable and his skills overrated, perhaps there was something more to the other spellmonger than bluff and blunder. It bore some investigation, at least. After I traded news with Cousy over the wisdom of spreading the word of the impending crisis, I bowed out of his office and let the man work. It was time I checked on my own preparations. I passed through Garkescu's empty quarters on my way and went up the wooden stairs to my new chambers. It was my turn to be impressed. Tyndall had done a masterful job arranging the barren tower into a genuine workspace. He had found ample private space for my professional items in those cramped quarters. I still wasn't completely happy with the situation, as I saw the plain straw tick where it sat on the floor. The castle was infested with rodents and bugs, and that just didn't look particularly inviting, not after enjoying a fluffy, wool-stuffed tick back at the shop. But it was the possibility of rats that got to be more. I've disliked rats intensely ever since Faris. They grew as large as dogs in that tropical climate, especially in an occupied city with plenty of corpses to feed upon, and they were all over every ship that took port there. I remember seeing them strut across the decks in broad daylight, like they owned the ship, and the best efforts of the ship's cats and my own magical rat traps barely put a dent in the population. Then I remember the sailor's trick for evading the pests at night, and I decided to have Tyndall secure a bolt of cloth wide enough to construct 2 hammocks we could sling from the stone walls. I've liked hammocks ever since I saw them in use at sea. They seemed especially helpful in the tight quarters of a castle under siege, and that would also free up more space for our work. Essentially satisfied, I went back down to the grounds of the Inner Bailey to make certain the mercenaries were settling in well. While their contract was technically with the Lord of Beauvall Vale, since I was the one who recruited them, I felt obligated to see to their comfort. The Crinrock brothers were actually settling into their camp on the eastern side fairly well, though in a circular arrangement that reminded me of a nomad camp, and was difficult to integrate into the rest of the encampments. The regular mercenaries encamped on the western side of the dungeon, and while their tents were lined up in a reasonably orderly fashion, the illusion of organization stopped there. I almost felt ashamed. The Crinrock were barbarians, outsiders, tribal savages. The other mercenaries were my people, Narasi, and they were botching up just about everything they touched and arguing over every point they could. I tried to gently intercede in one of the dozen or so conflicts between factions that had formed in the unit, but quickly became entangled in the opinions and supposed rights each unit claimed to have. I finally got pissed enough to discharge a particularly loud cantrip to get their attention. Interesting note. Even simple magic was much easier to do with the Irionite. Before, it had taken at least minimal concentration to perform even a candle lighting, but now I tossed out my hand and a flashbang smoke cantrip materialized with almost no effort on my part. "May I please have your attention, you misbegotten sons of poxy whores," I began politely, as I stepped on top of a pile of crates just to be heard in the silence after the cantrip burst, but before the smoke cleared. It was a flashy effect, but it worked admirably to get their attention and remind them just who the nine hells they were dealing with. "Since you obviously don't have the sense to pour piss out of a boot, I'm going to have to restore some order, or the locals will start confusing you with the Crinrock. If anybody takes offense to that, they can bring it to my attention, right here, right now," I said, patting Slasher in its sheath over my shoulder. "We will be glad to discuss whatever petty concern you have and settle it quickly, one way or another." There were grumbles and chuckles, but more of the latter than the former. They had spent almost 2 weeks on the road with me and knew my stern face well. Dozens of their own faces looked up at me with a mixture of surprise, regret, and anger, but they quieted down. They took me true to my word. Most of the trip I spent concentrating on the march and hadn't worried much with the quality of troops I was leading. That had to change now, and for the entire afternoon I dived into the task of integrating them with the rest of the besieged army with a vengeance. It was actually pretty simple. It turned out that apart from the Crinrock, I had a few hundred infantry of various sorts, and a few dozen cavalry troopers. Most were the Black Flag, and therefore under Captain Ferrando, who was pretty good about keeping discipline. My infantry, however, was rotten. They weren't bad, man by man, but they were definitely not a unit, and some were questionable even as arrow fodder. I reorganized them into 2 50-man companies, dissolving previous units to create them, and told off 7 as officers. I put Captain Besser in charge of the whole thing. There were some older and presumably wiser heads there, but I liked Besser. For one thing, he listened to me. He reminded me more of the professionals I had met in Faris, and he didn't take any shit. Nor was he very heavy-handed, which sounds like a contradiction, but isn't. Of the other 6, I made 2 lieutenants, each in charge of a company, and 4 ancients, each in charge of a 25-man platoon. I had the ancients wear a yellow sash, the lieutenants got a blue one, and I made Besser wear a bright red plume in his helmet, much like Ferrando's. In any regular war situation, I would have worried that the insignia would be confusing during pitched battle. Colored sashes are commonly used to distinguish sides in regular, civilized warfare, but I figured that when the enemy is uniformly short, dark, and hairy, the color of a man's sash wouldn't matter. Then came the hard part, arming them. Almost all of them had swords of one sort or another, because in Alshar you weren't a fighting man unless you carried one. These were personal items, not usually supplied by the client, but after inspecting some of those rusty sticks, I had over a dozen sent back to the smithy for repair or replacement. I had purchased a few score short infantry swords, the type useful for defending a narrow passageway, or the top of a battlement, and I distributed them among the mercenaries who needed them. The rest were more difficult. I had a pretty fair-sized armory at my disposal, so I had good choices to make. In a siege, though, which weapons are going to be most useful? Long, sharp, pointy ones, or heavy, blunt, short ones? How about archery? In Castol, and in the coastal regions of Alshar far to the south, I knew the siege weapon of choice was the crossbow. They are ideal for keeping besiegers at bay, or, conversely, clearing battlements of defenders. You can teach a peasant how to use one in a few days, and they are both relatively accurate and extremely powerful. But they also took a skilled artisan to create and maintain, and the Wilderlands were short of quality arbalists. But nearly every peasant in the Wilderlands hunts for game, or has to contend with predators after their herds and livestock. That made them somewhat skilled at basic archery. Much of the peasant militia were armed with the great hickory and yew laminate bows known elsewhere as the Wilderlands bow, as tall as a man and ideal for sniping at wolves and bandits. But arrows were something that I knew we would be perpetually short of. Wilderlands bows fire arrows up to 3 feet long. Ideally, they are also laminates, the shafts made of hard hickory on the front and lightweight cedar in the rear. They used iron or steel points and were fletched, usually with goose feathers. Every archer tended to make his own arrows, and though Kusi had a goodly supply stashed in his storerooms, it wouldn't take long to empty them during a busy siege. But shooting at wolves and shooting during war are two different things. Archers are most deadly when firing in volleys, something most of my men had only a vague idea of how to do. The Wilderlands bow takes up a lot of room when it's employed, too, not an ideal for battlements where men frequently stood elbow to elbow. They're also constructed to fit the man who will fire it. Though there were a few score of them in storage, they aren't like crossbows. You can't just hand them out and expect folks to be proficient with them. I finally told off one platoon, which seemed to have an abundance of bows already, to serious archery practice, while I made the other platoon in that company sword and shield men. To the other company I issued spears, perhaps not as long as the pikes of the Gobarban order, but several campfire conversations with the commanding abbot had given me ideas about just how they could be useful in a siege. Once the troops were well ordered, I set their new ancients to drilling them in basic manoeuvres, while I dealt with the unit where egos were more important to success than arms, the horsemen. I showed up for my induction into military service on time. I was hungover, whored out, and ready to piss myself in fear and anxiety. But, Duin and Trig helped me, I showed up. It was partly out of fear of the censorate's famed hunters, who would pursue a mage as an oathbreaker if he did not. But I also showed up partly out of a sense of relief that I didn't have to decide what to do with my life just yet. Even with my credentials, it would be hard to get a position, I knew. Despite my academic success, few professional firms want to invest in a mage right out of school, untested and untried, unless there was nepotism or family ties involved. I was looking at a year's worth of wandering around, starving to death and trying to establish a name for myself, had I not been drafted for the campaign. At least His Grace's summons gave me a steady, if paltry, income. Meals, a billet, and some direction. The same held true for about a third of my class of new war magi. Everyone who was not related to someone powerful enough to buy their way out, or pull strings, was present at the ancient hulking fortress of Relancor that rainy autumn day, not out seeking a position. Not, coincidentally, many of the guys from my tower were there. But we weren't all born commoners. Some of the North Tower lordlings, sons of knights and lords, were eager for the combat experience. There were also a few gutsy Remirans who weren't ready to settle down with the family firm just yet. The magical core seemed like a decent proposal for all of us at the time, which just goes to show you how woefully ignorant we were of the political situation at the time. While we were in school, the renegade province of Faris had been systematically raiding the trading fleets that regularly made the lucrative trip from Shutek, Unstara, and the southern archipelagos to various parts of the duchies. They'd also raided the important shipping between the rich port cities of southern Alshar and the eastern duchies, disrupting the cotton, tobacco, and wool trade, not to mention taking highborn passengers for ransom. This was nothing new. The Farisians had caused trouble for the powers that be since before the inundation of Perwin. Faris isn't even really a country. It's a kind of city-state. It was founded about the middle of the first Majocracy as a pirate haven for Cormoran corsairs, who used it as a base to raid Imperial shipping between Alshar, which had been settled by fellow Cormoran corsairs who had retired with their riches to become wealthy landowners, and the rest of the Majocracy, and it remains a port city to rival any in the duchies to this day. Its location at the Cape of the Frisian Peninsula gave it a perfect position for raiding. The city grew up around the port and extended north to foothills. It was a good place to spend pirated loot or retire to after a life of trading and raiding. When the pirates got too bad, the Archmage, I forget which one, sent a fleet to reason with, read conquer, the miscreants and establish order. In their place he installed one of his distant relatives he feared was conspiring for the throne. The new imperial regent took the title Doge, and from that point on Faris was an outpost of imperial civilization and an important trading port. The Doge ruled the province in the name of the Archmagi, and things settled down. Then, a few hundred years later, my ancestors, a bunch of horse-riding illiterate barbarians from the Great Northern Steppes, had gotten tired of being pushed around by the Archmage and decided that enough was enough. With some assistance from some treacherous rebels and disaffected Magi, the Narasi clans invaded the Valley of Vor, swept away the lackluster imperial military resistance, and conquered all of the old Majocracy within two lifetimes. Except for Faris. My people are not very good sailors under the best conditions, and we were apparently so involved with looting the pristine civilization of the mainland that we overlooked that remote little outpost. The Doge continued imperial traditions and took in plenty of expatriates, fleeing the barbarians. A few even tried to form a Majocracy in exile in response to my ancestors' heavy-handed approach to magical regulation. But the Doge would not surrender political power, and most of those pretenders fell as quickly as they rose. Faris, both the city and the narrow strip of cultivated land around it, is at the end of a long southward-jutting peninsula that is almost impassable. Jagged mountains form a spine for the land, and savage jungles on both coasts cut off any decent access from the mainland. It was far easier and cheaper for merchants to sail around it between Castal and Alshar than to contend with the wild tribes of Human, Gavani, and Alka Alon, who range these areas. The local wildlife is especially vicious. Strange diseases often infect those who venture into the jungles, and the near-constant rain makes travel all but impossible. So if you want to attack Faris, you'd better have a strong navy. Stronger than the Farisi. The Doge and his cronies had been left alone by the duchies for the most part during the last 400 years, but that didn't mean they didn't stop raiding. The Farisi seemed to think that just because they controlled the strategically placed Farisian peninsula and had a powerful native fleet, that they had a right to tribute from any ducal ships passing by. This had happened before, of course. Usually it was an excuse to shake down the coronet council for protection money, and usually the council paid with only a little grumbling. But there had been an incident involving the family of one of the dukes. The Doge's pet Magi had started using dangerous spells, and Irianite, as we discovered later, and one thing led to another toward war. By the time I left the academy, the Coronet Council had decided that an independent Faris was a luxury they could not tolerate. In a rare show of solidarity, the three westernmost of them, Alshar, Rhemir, and Castal, had authorized a joint mission to secure the rebellious old Imperials. They pooled their military assets and went to war with the Imperial remnant, intending to invade. This was actually the second time an invasion had been ordered. The previous year, the Coronet Council had authorized a punitive fleet to trim back the pirates in a show of naval force. It had, after all, worked for the Majocracy. It was commanded by a mariner friend to the Castali ducal court. He proceeded to ruin the fleet in a series of vicious battles in the Farisian Strait, narrowly losing or destroying every one of his 40 great warships, and hundreds of ships carrying occupation troops, because the Doge employed his court wizard, Oral Pratt, to destroy and confuse them with magic. The designated admiral at least had the good grace to die in battle at sea and avoid the shame of his failure. But like their horse-lord ancestors had done with the Majocracy, The Dukes of Rhemir, Castal, and Alshar, with the tacit support of the other two, finally had enough of the situation. The added insult of losing 20 warships to the Farisi was too much for the honour of the 5 Narasi dukes. Invasion plans began afresh, and a fully staffed magical corps was called for to combat the Mad Mage of Faris. As it was easier and cheaper to draft magi fresh out of school than to hire well-established mercenaries, the warlord had us pressed into service before we could find real jobs. The campaign warlord figured he could take the pesky little city-state within the year, with a few hundred well-trained, well-armed war magi at his disposal. Only it hadn't quite worked out that way. The Doge's ally, Oral Pratt, might have been unstable, but he had also acquired a chip of near-mythical Irionite from somewhere, and wasn't afraid of the censorate or the dangers of using it. No great fleet could approach Faris by sea while he was on watch. By the time I arrived at Relan Kor, he was wreaking havoc on even the light patrol boats the Dukes used to regularly probe the Farisi coastal defences. Large squadrons were broken up by mage-wrought storms, or sunk when their hulls began leaking uncontrollably, or burst into magical flames. The might of the Mad Mage was such that even the most powerful magi in the Eastern Duchies were unwilling to face him. Defeating the combination of his magic, Faris's unassailable geography, and the sailors who expertly handled the shallow-drafted, yellow-sailed penances of Faris was not going to be easy. But it had to be done. The Dukes said so. Which is how, 3 weeks after graduating from Inarian Academy and finally getting my credentials to practice magic, I found myself instead standing in a soaking cloak in a continuous drizzle, drops of icy rain running down my nose, while a strange man with a jaw like an anvil screamed into my face and questioned the legitimacy of my conception and birth. I found my time at the War College constructive. For the first 9 weeks, we were shoved in a barracks with the young nobles who were training for officer status in the infantry. Indeed, most of our training was identical to theirs. Swordsmanship, horsemanship, archery, unarmed combat, small unit tactics, logistics and supply, scouting and reconnaissance, command of battle, siegecraft and field fortifications, war rites and battle rituals, leadership, first aid, and all the other crap they feel every officer should know. We weren't technically field officers, but the magical corps traditionally billeted with them, so we learned what they learned. Like marching. We marched. A lot. Too much, I thought at the time. Not nearly enough, I know now. We marched in armor and out, with packs and without, and even without shoes for 2 unbearable days. We were outfitted in the standard magical corps armor, a kind of wax leather vest with steel plates sewn over the vital areas, and taught how to give them basic enchantments to augment their protection. Despite their ugliness, they did have a one-size-fits-all kind of security about them. The basic pattern left plenty of room for movement, wasn't too heavy, and didn't keep you from casting spells in combat. Mostly. We also got our mage blades. Those are the specialized weapons of war magi, somewhere between the length of an infantry sword and a cavalry sword, with a point, a double-sided blade, and spaces cut within to lighten them and allow for custom and theoretically devastating enchantments. The style had been around since the Majocracy, and they are traditionally worn on the back, attached to a leather harness and drawn over your shoulder. They, too, were standardized and unadorned, but nearly every student eventually paid to have theirs customized to fit them better. A few even learned enough blacksmithing to do it themselves. We were required to give them names to aid in spellcasting. I named mine Slasher, because that's what it seemed best at. After we were reasonably trained in the standard ways of war, and were given the opportunity to participate in the mysteries of Duin, I declined. The only goddess I really worshipped was Briga, who has little to do with warfare. The weather began making it more practical to study indoors. We were separated from the rest of the officers to learn the ancient and potent craft of war magic. Even with my years of study at Inarian, I was still amazed by the things I learned at War College. Inarian gave me a theoretical basis for understanding spells. At Relan Kor, I took my precious knowledge of the human body and learned how to destroy it 1,000 different ways. I learned things about the forces of light and shadow, photomantics, fire and ice, pyromantics, and toxic, corrosive and explosive chemicals, battlefield alchemy, that I never would have dreamed were possible at Inarion. I learned how to build a war staff, war wands, and 100 nasty magical traps and weapons. I learned the art of illusion, concealment, and misdirecting an enemy's gaze to where I wanted it. I learned to strike without hesitation or remorse. Just kill, 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 until my objective was complete. Our head instructor was the legendary one-eyed Master Durgan Jol, a war master and war magi famous 1,000 times over. The scrappy old man gave us the benefit of his 40 years as a magical mercenary, working with each and every one of us until we could all hold our own in duels, both magical and mundane. Support magic was a big part of the training. War magi are rarely frontline troops. We're specialists, and usually we specialized in keeping frontline troops safe, comfortable, and informed. We learned spells to inspire our friends and drive our foes to despair. We learned to clear fear from our minds and focus utterly on the task at hand. Late in our courses, they taught us advanced war magic techniques, how to supplement our own body's energy with magical energy to restore ourselves from fatigue, how to speed up reflexes and hone my perceptions with magic until I was more than a match for a regular infantryman. War magic allowing us to move 3 times as fast as the fastest mortal and 2x as far in the same time. We learned his seemingly endless bag of battle cantrips, small spells not inherently dangerous, but useful in the faster-than-a-blink world of the War Mage. Camouflage, stealth, armor spells, clairvoyant spells designed to gather enemy intelligence, counterintelligence spells to avoid enemy intelligence, and a special 3-day tutorial on healing battlefield traumas that was as useful as it was morbid. It came complete with fresh corpses. We practiced war games all winter, and I adapted myself to the soldier's life. Very different from the life of an academic, but just as rewarding in its way. When spring finally came, we were deemed ready to face the Doge and the Mad Mage. They split us into 3 groups, depending upon our overall performance. Group A was comprised of those whose physical performance was not considered strong enough to make the trip. Group A would be in charge of strategic magical support, keeping the weather in line for the amphibious assault and scrying enemy positions. Group B was made up of those who excelled at one particular type of war magic, the sneaky type, the brutal type, or the healing type. Group B was taken aside for advanced training in their field of excellence and destined for special missions. Group C was anyone who was left. I was in Group C. It seems thaumaturgy and magical theory were not considered highly useful battlefield skills. I didn't mind. I was ready to go and wreak havoc on the enemies of the duchies, thanks to the miracle workers of the War College. Master Durgan Jol and his fellows had taken 200 bookish students and turned them into a pack of vicious and highly efficient killers, adept at the craft of war magic. A pity he never made it back from Faris. But then neither did many of his students. The Black Flag Mercenary Company were about as professional a cavalry unit as I could have hoped for in the Wilderlands, setting up their camp and seeing to their horses without too much acrimony. The Kelso Knights, however, were a haughty bunch of aristocrats who had been born with silver candlesticks up their asses. They didn't want to bed down next to common troops. They didn't like the food. They objected to the wine. They complained about the pay. They didn't like the duties they were assigned. They didn't like the entertainment possibilities. I almost put them with the Crinrock out of spite after one particularly nasty debate when Sire Kusi arrived and saved the day by hosting his noble Wilderlord peers in the keep. The Kelso Knights profoundly irritated me. They were just as much mercenaries as the rest of them, but for some reason a noble mercenary feels he has the right to bitch that the sky is the wrong shade of blue and the water is too wet. They tend to think that regular military rules don't apply to them. The chivalrous mercenaries were warriors, but they weren't really soldiers, used to taking and executing simple orders. Everything was open to discussion, debate, and everyone felt entitled to advance his stupid opinion before any course of action was carried out. Sire Kusi offered them a large chamber, which they complained about, and seats in the hall, instead of making them eat with the common men, to which they reluctantly and vocally agreed. I was just as glad to get rid of them as they were causing trouble in the Black Flag. Ferrando may have been a nobleman, or at least raised as one, but the mercenary captain knew how to soldier, and the Wilderlords just didn't. It took a whole day of arguing to finally sort out where they would live and what they would do. I let Kusi deal with the matter of their pay. I was just too tired. As dusk approached, and I was reasonably certain my men were well provided for, I stumbled back up to the tower. Garkescu still wasn't in, but I found Tyndall unpacking the gear I'd purchased in Tudri like a good apprentice. I spied one package in particular, and decided that it was as good a time as any to present it to him. The last few weeks had taught me how much I appreciated the lad's thoughtful consideration, and his genuine desire to please. Sure, he was an uneducated commoner, but I had a newfound appreciation of his pragmatic earnestness after dealing with the Knights of Kelso. After a brief inspection of our quarters, I sat the boy down on my own stool, poured him a glass of mediocre local wine, and toasted him like an adult, if not an equal. Though he was bordering on embarrassment, he awkwardly returned the toast before he downed it with a satisfied sigh. I'd have to watch that. He was starting to drink like me. Tyndall, you know perhaps better than anyone else in the castle what we are up against here. We may not, hells, we will probably not survive, but we at least will go down fighting like men, instead of being murdered in our beds or ambushed along the road. But that means each of us will have to do some fighting, and if we are to be fighting men, then we should be adorned as such. With that, I pulled out the oilcloth-wrapped bundle that he thankfully had yet to put away, and undid the coarse string that bound it. Within were the weapons for which I had paid a high premium to the Tudri Warmage, Master Cormoran. First was a mage blade, similar to my own slasher, only built to Tyndall's height and arm length. The scabbard was plain black unadorned leather, and the hilt was brass, but the blade was superior to that of a mere infantryman, worthy of any golden hilt and bejeweled scabbard. It was, by far, the least of Cormoran's stock. The Veolic di Ordo were fine weaponsmiths, and produced superb steel mage blades that were flexible enough not to snap, yet strong enough to cut through all but the stoutest armor. The edge of the sword was keen and flawless, and the flat was brightly polished. Most importantly, it was made to bear offensive spells, like a war wand. Cormoran had thrown in a small war mage's harness for just a few pennies more. Tyndall was in awe as I belted it around him and slung the blade over his right shoulder. Next, I gave him the bow I had picked out, a little too short for open battle, but well-suited to the siege I was expecting. There was nothing especially magical about the bow, but it was well-built and strong, and the 20 of professionally made arrows I purchased were well-fletched, with gorgeous grey goose feathers. Every boy in Beauval knows his way around a bow. House Brandmount had not seen any reason to limit hunting rights for its yeomen and freemen, and I suspected that, with practice, he would learn to shoot exceptionally well. The goblins should give him plenty of practice. Lastly, I gave him the professional strength war wand I had bought for him. It was a multi-purpose weapon, as it could use the regular magical blast, or convert that power into either flame or steam. There weren't that many charges on it, but he could always add more, once I taught him precisely how. "Master, I have been busy while you've been gone," he said smugly, after accepting my gifts gratefully and graciously. "I've been practicing what you showed me." He handed me the war wand that he had started on the road, his first. One I never expected to work particularly well. It was all but covered with runes now, and I could feel the vibrant power in it. I raised an eyebrow. I was impressed. "That is superior work, my boy. But don't add any more, now." He looked disturbed. "Why not?" "Because that's not the best wood for the use. You've loaded the thing up tight with arcane power. Add any more and it will break. When a war wand breaks, it will usually kill the wielder and destroy everything around it in a sudden and unpredictable explosion or wave. He paled when I said that. I chuckled. I wouldn't worry about it, lad. It's a stout enough wand. Keep it close at hand. But in battle you should work on the larger one I bought you for now. It's more efficient and can handle a lot more energy. Pacified, he poured us each another glass, unbidden. To the life of a spellmonger under dire circumstances, I toasted and poured it down. I suddenly realized that I was very, very tired as the wine hit my belly. I sought out my mattress and sprawled out, pausing only long enough to take off my boots and my harness. The hammock idea would have to wait. If I saw any rats, I decided as I drifted off, I'd just change them into something a little less interesting. The next morning I was up with the dawn, on the roof of the tower, overseeing the magical situation. Garkescu and his oldest apprentice were with me, still a little skeptical of my abilities and my judgment, but unwilling to argue with me openly any more. I had produced an army, after all. That wasn't something Garki was able to do. I was surveying the hills with mage sight, looking for scouts or skirmishers in the forests. I wasn't having much luck, but mage sight, even with the benefit of Irionite, doesn't work nearly as well in daylight. While I was up there, however, my attention was distracted by a lovely young girl, who looked about 17 or so, bathing in the outer bailey. The curtains that were suspended from poles protected her modesty from passers-by were long and opaque, but from my vantage point I could see everything that Trigg had graced her with. She had dark blonde hair and a shapely figure, and I could tell she had a pretty face, too. I'd been so involved in war preparations that I had almost forgotten that there were women aplenty in the castle. Indeed, the outer bailey had almost every woman in the valley within its walls. This one was quite lovely, well-formed and delightfully female. I made a mental note to make her acquaintance, then suddenly realized that I already had. I increased the focus on my mage sight and confirmed that yes, indeed, it was the farm widow Alia who was bathing so enticingly. She was kept from further lechery at a distance by my irritating colleague.
"Master Menelan, is that a rider?"
Garkescu pointed to the road in front of the gate. I swore under my breath and turned away from that lovely sight to the realities of war. It was indeed a rider, I saw, and one on a very lathered horse. I magnified my mage sight with a whispered command. The man was an armored wilderlord who bore the banner of Brandmount Castle from the point of his lance. "He must be bearing news," I said, forming a spell to allow me to hear his words. Clairaudience, the long-ears spell they taught me at Relancor, has never been a strength of mine, but everything was easier now that I had my witchstone. As the spell activated, it was as if I'd had a plug of wax removed from my ears, and I could hear the man's breathing and the panting of his horse as he rode past the guards into the stables, as if I was riding next to him. One of Kusi's senior staff, Sir Norlian, was there and demanded the message.
"The goblins have attacked Mortar, cutting off the Moor Pass," the messenger said between labored breaths, "and a large band of the bastards has the temerity to raid Himmus itself. I saw as I came past."
"Guess what, Master Garkescu?" I said, a lump in my throat.
"We are at war,"
the older mage replied. I was surprised. I didn't think he'd had time to hang the same spell I had, nor the power. Hells, I doubted that he even knew of the long ears.
"We are at war, and Himmus is burning."
"Yes, you're right," I admitted. "How did you know?" I asked, turning to face him. He and his oldest apprentice were staring at the distant town, where a long black plume of smoke rose up over the trees and hills.
"I saw the portents in the sky," he snorted dryly. "So the rider agreed with my assessment?"
"With one addition. Moor Tower is under attack, and escape out of the veil is cut off." He hung his head sadly and looked depressed.
"Then we are at war, and we are all going to die," he said.
I didn't say anything in reply, although it was the perfect time for some optimistic chatter. When I heard the rider talk of Moor Tower, I suddenly felt as if an iron door had slammed shut. The reality of our situation came to bear. There were thousands of Gavanni creeping down the mountains, angry and determined, led by shamans armed with Irionite. There was a malevolent force that was urging them on. There really was no other way to get in and out of Bovol, unless you wanted to try the Gavanni-infested mountain ridges. I suddenly didn't know what in the nine hells I had done to get trapped in such a situation. A quip, or at least a hopeful phrase, might have cheered the other spellmonger. I couldn't think of one offhand that might serve. But mostly, I didn't say anything, because I had to agree. We were all going to die. Chapter 7 The Last Charge of the Bovali Knights. Castles stink. They look so lofty, strong, and imposing from a distance. The peasantry often considers them palaces, but they aren't. They're oversized military fortifications with a fairly small resident staff. In peacetime, the number of residents is small enough not to notice the many odors involved. Most people who have been fortunate enough never to have to depend on one to save their lives will not appreciate this. But castles in wartime smell worse than a pigsty. First, there was the barnyard stench of the tightly packed livestock, which fades into the background pretty quickly, especially if you are accustomed to it, as most of us are. Personally, horseshit smells pretty good to me, almost symbolic of the majesty of the beasts. Usually it was saved up to be spread on the fields as valuable fertilizer, but in a siege, it just got piled up outside of the castle wall until better times. Add to that the aroma of pig, chicken, the ubiquitous cow and miscellaneous small critters, and it can get pretty ripe, especially around the slaughtering pit. Most of the offal was fed back to the pigs or mixed in with the manure. But in addition to the aroma of the animals is the mass of infrequently washed agricultural humanity crowded into the outer bailey under tarpaulins. A few thousand men, women and children, none of who bathed all that regularly in the best of times, were suddenly crammed ass to elbow into a confined space, along with enough privies to, theoretically, service them all. Hastily dug latrines dotted the outer bailey, but that's a lot of poop. It all went into the moat, the protective ditch that surrounded the castle, as a deterrent to invaders, but also because, frankly, there wasn't a better place to put it, where it festered and fermented and stank like, well, poop. It gets worse. Mixed in with the natural sweat of men and women working diligently on any number of labors was an almost palpable stench of fear, I noted. These ordinary people were confronted with the possibility of violent death from an inhuman enemy, and that produced a particular smell, distinct from the ordinary sweat of daily living and honest toil. The barbers and physicians had set up shop and contributed the odor of vomit and diarrhea to the air. They hung evergreen boughs from their tents to try to mask the smell of sickness, but it was laughably ineffective, unless you held it directly under your nose. Odors of wood smoke from cooking fires, and the moldy smell emanating from barrels of stagnant water placed strategically around the castle in the event of fire, added to the stink. The worksheds that lined the castle walls and housed all of the artisans necessary to keeping a siege running contributed to it. Blacksmiths, with the associated acrid tang of coke fires, chandlers rendering tallow into candles, tanners with the ungodly stink of purification and powerful tannins, all added to the revolting stench, until it was almost overwhelming. The combination of this riot of smells forced me to use a cantrip that deadened my nose just to get through the day. While I couldn't taste my food properly with the spell, I wasn't missing much. Castle rations are poor even for officers, but it was a small price to pay for the luxury of not gagging every time I inhaled. Thankfully, it was potent enough to combat the worst of the odors and let me do my job. The only smell that was powerful enough to make it through the spell was the sickening scent of fear. That smell permeated every nook and cranny of Bovol Castle, and with good reason. The smoke over Himmus on the horizon caused quite a commotion in the castle the day before. The peasants and townsfolk camped in the outer bailey saw it just a few moments after we did, and quickly gathered to peer over the walls in dismay. A frightened moan ran through the crowded campground as the grumblers and whiners, who had been certain that the rumors of Gervani attacks had been exaggerated or fabricated entirely by the nobility, suddenly realized, as their shops and homes burned in the distance, that their lives really were in danger. The black cloud made them anxious and restless. Some spread the rumor that a massive goblin army had already arrived. If a stout little town like Himmers could fall so quickly, the reasoning ran, then an attack on Beauvall Castle surely couldn't be far behind. I couldn't argue with that, especially after witnessing the pillage that the Gervani vanguard put to Himmers town by means of mage sight. They stole everything they could and burned the rest. Any civilian stragglers were captured and slaughtered, and the remaining men-at-arms patrolling the town were driven back to the castle. That many anxious folks inside the castle, witnessing their life going up in smoke on the horizon, made the smell even worse. They didn't know what was happening to their homes, though they could imagine well enough. So when Sir Kusi ordered a cavalry force organized to investigate and, if possible, drive off the goblins, I volunteered just to get away from the stench. While I knew it was probably a futile effort, it was psychologically very important for us to at least appear to strike at the goblins, so that the Wilderland peasants would cling to some hope of better days and brighter futures. Besides, I figured we might as well use the cavalry we had available while we could. In a matter of days, if not sooner, I fully expected us to be locked up in this pile of stones where horses were more of a liability than an asset until the meat ran out. For now, I wanted to escape from the smell of fear of terrified men, more than I feared the smell of goblins. Sire Kusi decided to lead the horsemen himself, as was his chivalrous prerogative. He sent a messenger to me that afternoon, ordering me to prepare the mercenary cavalry for a patrol with his gentlemen and to meet him at the gatehouse. I honestly wasn't yet trusting of their loyalty, so riding with Sire Kusi, Sir Stancil, and his other sworn wilderlords seemed a fair idea. So I strapped on my weapons harness and found Captain Ferrando, who had anticipated the order and had the men already preparing their mounts. The black flag moved with more military efficiency, if not quite precision, than the Wilderlords. While the knights' horses were being saddled and their armor was being strapped on their bodies by squires or other attendants, I sat with Sir Ferrando and briefed him on the geography of Himmers. The Kelso knights rode out of the stables almost merrily, and seemed eager to get out of the castle and into glory. I ignored them while I discussed the situation with Ferrando. Sire Kusi joined us presently, and I made formal introductions between the mercenary captain and the Lord of Beauvall Vale, whom they served, purposefully slighting the Kelsoi. I'm just that way. The two men were a study in contrasts. Kusi was, of course, far older than the mercenary captain, and shorter in stature. His longish, grey-white hair and beard spilled out of his helmet onto his shoulders, giving him a stately mantle that seemed to embody what he was, a Wilderlord knight, trained from birth to fight with sword and lance in the defense of his lands. He wore a shimmering coat of well-blued chainmail, augmented by steel pauldrons, and he wore an ornately decorated longsword on his hip. His surcoat was emblazoned with the simple device of his house, a white cow on a green field. He had a look of grim determination that barely masked the fear and anxiety I knew was in him. Fear not for his own life, but for the lives of the people entrusted to his care. Ferrando, on the other hand, had the weary look of the professional campaigner about him, as well as the cautious air of a mercenary. Tall and lanky, he wore his long, dark hair in a serviceable ponytail under his unadorned steel cavalry helmet. His well-scuffed leather and steel armor seemed a little too large for him in places, though he seemed to be able to move with alacrity in it. He wore no surcoat or device, only a black headband around the brow of his helm, and a black wool mantle to identify him as captain of the black flag. His sword was a plain, serviceable cavalryman's longsword, with the triple spiral of trig on its brass pommel. He had a short-handled mace, dangling from his belt by a lanyard, as well as a long dagger tucked behind the small of his back. Neither was decorated, that I could see. Though he bore a serviceable lance, it was a tool in his hands, not a scepter of office, and it lacked a pennant. Ferrando ordered his subordinates about without recourse to vile profanity, though he used the ordinary sort as liberally as any military commander does when dealing with mounted troops. His mood was melancholy but practical, and while he had some fear in him, it was no more and no less than the fear that any professional soldier has before going into battle and uncertainty. He was just doing the job he'd been hired to do. The two men got along famously. Cusi outlined the plan quickly and succinctly. This was not a punitive expedition. This was an attempt to locate the enemy, engage them, if numbers were favorable, gauge their defense, and retreat safely back to the castle. Ferrando agreed wholeheartedly. A mercenary captain doesn't like to risk his men unnecessarily if he can help it, and a captain of horse is more protective of his beasts than of his daughter's virtue. The two commanders traded war stories and advice, until messengers arrived reporting on the readiness of both the Black Flag and the much smaller Kelsoy heavy cavalry unit. "My lord," I said as Cusi strode purposefully towards the step that led up to his mount, "I beg leave to come with you. Most probably the Govani have shamans of their own with them, and I am loath to leave you undefended against magical attack." Cusi looked concerned. "I had expected you to stay here, in case this is a ruse designed to lead us away from our strong points." "My lord, this castle will not fall on the absence of one man, even a war mage. The wards are as tight as they can be made.